From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's this impression about feminism the historian Jill Lepore is trying to correct. People have this idea, she says, that when women won the right to vote in 1920, the fight for women's rights went into hibernation or something until the 60s when it picked up again. But that's not what happened, and Lepore's evidence for that is Wonder Woman. The comic book hero created in 1941 was a character whose only weakness was that she loses all her strength if a man binds her in chains. She was inspired by the feminism of the first half of the century and was the inspiration for the feminism to come. As Lepore puts it in her book, Wonder Woman isn't only an Amazonian princess with badass boots, she's the missing link in the story. Jill Lepore is joining us today to talk about Wonder Woman. After the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Jill Lepore is with us to talk about the story of Wonder Woman. Lepore calls Wonder Woman that missing link in the history of women's rights in the 20th century. The movement, she says, in fact, didn't go away after women won the right to vote. And Wonder Woman is proof of that. You see her beginning in the 1940s fighting for women's rights in the pages of a very popular comic book. Wonder Woman was the creation, at least in part, of a man, a brilliant but odd man who had complicated ideas and lived a complicated personal life. But she was also inspired by strong, outspoken women activists. One of them was Margaret Sanger, one of the most ardent feminists of her time, the founder of, co-founder anyway, of Planned Parenthood. Jill Lepore's book tells about the origins of Wonder Woman, which is the history of the long, ongoing struggle for equality for women. The book is now out in paperback. It's called The Secret History of Wonder Woman. And Jill Lepore is joining us. She is a professor of American history at Harvard University, a staff writer for The New Yorker. And she's joining us today from the studio on the campus of Harvard. And Jill Lepore, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to let me begin here, because there's a lot of talk going on right now in the Republican Party about defunding Planned Parenthood. And I guess the same kind of thing, or a similar kind of thing, was happening a few years ago when you kind of came across this story. You know, you were, as I understand it anyway, you were looking into Margaret Sanger's oral history. And one thing sort of leads to another, and you start to put together this story. Is that essentially how you started thinking about all of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely the case that I backed into this project writing about Wonder Woman. I had never been a Wonder Woman fan. I wasn't caught up in the Wonder Woman TV show that was on when I was a kid in the 1970s. I didn't read the comic book. I don't come to this project as a comic book fan historian. I come to it as a political historian.
Yeah.
And I came to it, frankly, with some reluctance. So a few years ago, the last Republican nomination cycle around, candidates for the GOP nomination were asked to sign a pledge, a pro-life pledge that had many tenets. But one of them was, if elected president, I promise to defund Planned Parenthood. So I was assigned by The New Yorker to write an article about the history of Planned Parenthood and to try to put that its controversial political state in a broader historical context.
Yeah.
So I'd been working on that project for a while, and to do that, I went out to Smith College in Western Massachusetts, which has this great women's history collection, and they happen to have the papers, the archives of Planned Parenthood, the organization, and the personal papers of Margaret Sanger, who's the founder of Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood was founded in 1916. So I was reading through all these papers, but meanwhile, I had been working on a different scholarly project, which was a lecture I was giving at the Yale Law School, a paper I was writing for a Yale Law School on the history of evidence, where I was really interested in the history of the lie detector. Right. I was really interested in the technologies of evidence. And so I've been working out about this, doing all this research about this guy named William Moulton Marston, who created the lie detector when he was a Harvard undergraduate in 1913, or did a lot of research that was pivotal in the creation of what we call the lie detector.
Right.
And so there was like very little you could find out about Marston anywhere. Like his Wikipedia entry just said, yeah, he created the lie detector, and then he went on in 1941 to invent Wonder Woman. But meanwhile, he believed in polyamory and had multiple women in his house with whom he raised children. So to circle around back to Planned Parenthood, so while I was out at the archives reading Margaret Sanger's papers, I kept coming across references to people who were in William Moulton Marston's family. And so I had this kind of epiphany in the archives where I realized through a variety of like little clues that there was this heretofore completely unseen tie, connection between Margaret Sanger and Wonder Woman through Marston.
You say you kind of came to the project, at least in some ways, you had some reluctance. What was the reluctance, do you think, about writing a book? Because it's about Wonder Woman, but it's not really about Wonder Woman in some ways. It's about the political history behind all of this. What was the reluctance part on your part?
The reluctance part was, you know, I don't have the, you know, if you talk to comic book fans, right, they will ask you questions like, in Sensation Comics number 41, in episode B, you know, where Dr. Psycho says this, why do you think that is, you know, like they have a kind of inexhaustible curiosity and encyclopedia kind of knowledge of the comics as comics, the history of comics. And I don't have that. And I also have a lot of ambivalence about Wonder Woman as a popular culture icon. She's one among many popular culture, female popular culture icons whose principal expression of power is through her sexuality and her desirability to men. And just, you know, I'm not excited. I don't get excited by that. I feel so defeated by that. That at the end of the day, that's just, I realize there's this whole sort of sex positive feminist movement going on, this kind of millennial thing that, like, whatever, people have different ideas about that, but that's not where, it just doesn't get me excited thinking about, oh, this is this, like, really exciting, important icon because she's so sexy and she makes sexiness so powerful. That to me is the defeat of a campaign for genuine political power. It's the absence of genuine political power is to express your power through your attractiveness to men. So that, like, if I write a book about Wonder Woman, it's going to appear that, like, Wonder Woman is the object of such great fascination for me. But really, it's the unseen political richness of the character that's the object of really great fascination for me.
Did you feel at all reluctant that the creator of Wonder Woman was a man, and a man whose motivations I can't quite figure out in some ways. And you do wonder if, I mean, and we'll walk through this because I think his early history of being connected to the feminist speakers and feminism is fascinating. But you do wonder how much of this is part of his sort of weird sexual proclivity, how much of this is his devotion to feminism. He did seem devoted to feminism, but then you wonder, I mean, I don't know, was that part of the reluctance in any way?
No, he's a fantastic character.
No,
you're kidding. He's tremendously exciting to write about. He's multifaceted. He's full of contradictions. I think what's tricky, he'd be more fun to write about as a novelist, because as a historian, I feel like there's historians, the good and faithful writing of history requires a great deal of restraint and discipline. So I think it's important not to beat your reader over the head with what you might think about people or actions in the past, but instead to present the reader with the best possible evidence, and in fact present the reader with conflicting evidence and really let the reader weigh and come to a conclusion. So I bet there are readers of this book about Wonder Woman like, oh, well, what do you actually think about Marston? I wasn't really sure in the end how to think about Marston. Well, I don't think that's clear. I don't think we can very easily sit in judgment of people who are dead and who we've never met and whose remains, the literary remains, what they leave behind is partial and selective and been much expurgated. I think it's a complicated task, and I like to invite the reader into the difficulty of that task rather than do it for them.
I have to say before we move on, it was a lot of fun hearing you read the book on the audiobook. Because you're always invoking Wonder Woman, and there's a lot of great dialogue there, and you did a pretty good job with it, I have to say.
as an utter novice. I'd never done that before. I've been asked to read, you know, do the narration for books before, but I'd always shied away from it. So I'm like, those people are so good. You know, when you listen to a great audiobook and that has that intimacy, well, you know, I mean, you work in radio, you know, that incredible, you're in the room with them. It's just the two of you and they're speaking to you and now they're whispering to you and now they're excited. You know, like just that, that animation and the emotional control that the narrator has over you. I'm just so in awe of what radio people do and voice actors do. So I was very reluctant to do it.
But
I
thought, no, but you did
right,
it.
I'll give it a try.
Well, I was like, Jill Lepore is nailing this. It was really fun.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, you keep asking about reluctance. I actually was very excited to write the book, and this is the reason why I was really excited to write the book. There has been an incredible revolution in the academic world in historical scholarship about women and family and private life in the last half century. People have been doing incredible archival research, coming up with fantastic new interpretations of the American past, of pasts of different people and times and places that really upend what we think we know about how power operates in society and what lives are documented and what counts as history. And very little of that incredible work by generations of women's historians, most of them women's female scholars, has reached a kind of mass public or even, you know, even the larger general reading public.
Yeah.
So what we know about the history of suffrage as a matter of historical scholarship, people don't actually know. You know, that's why, like, we have this campaign about who's going to be on the 20 if we put a woman on. Most people, like, they're hard-pressed to get beyond Harriet Tubman and Eleanor Roosevelt. Like, people just don't know women's history, even though so much tremendous scholarship has been done. So the reason I was excited when I finally decided to write the book is like, oh, this will be a great, I'm not that interested in women, but this is a great opportunity to deliver the whole history of women's political struggle for equality in the United States in the guise of something that people think that is actually kind of cool and interesting, because she's Wonder Woman and she is cool and interesting.
Well, one of the things that struck me was that if you look at the story of Sadie Elizabeth Holloway, she becomes Marston's wife. She is a part of this this movement, the new women, and who are interested in this is in the 1920s. Or even before then, I think, of wanting to have it all, in the sense that having this remarkable freedom to choose a career, live out a career, yet also be, you know, rear children, be a mother, and that dilemma, this many years on, that seems to be the same kind of dilemma that women are working through.
It is, and it's really discouraging to see that the choices are, I would say, possibly narrower in some by some measures than they were for Sadie Holloway. So Marston and his wife were both born in the same year, 1893, these sort of Victorian fam, the tail end of Victorianism, and they both go to college in 1911. Marston goes to Harvard, and Sadie Elizabeth Holloway goes to Mount Holyoke, the first college for women. And she's in this, is exactly as you say, like one of the first generations of women to actually go to college. Not a lot of men went to college in the 19-teens either, but very, very few women did. And they often went to these women's colleges. And when she graduated in 1915, she and Marston married. They'd been, you know, childhood sweethearts. And yet she was the first member of her graduating class from Mount Holyoke to marry, but she didn't. She'd been to college. She didn't want to just become a housewife and a mother. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's not what she wanted. She had been raised to a set of expectations as a young woman at Mount Holyoke in the 19-teens when women were fighting for the right to vote. There were suffrage parades all over campus. The campus itself was a hotbed of suffragism. Feminism, the word, comes to be used in like 1910, 1911 when she's at college.
Right.
The women's colleges are swept up with this, not just with suffragism, but with feminism, which is different from the suffrage movement. Feminists want equality with men in all realms. Educationally, professionally, artistically, politically, and they don't just want the right to vote. They want equality. They want all kinds of equality with men. So she's swept up in this, and she's this generation that historians refer to and people at the time refer to as the new woman. So it's a whole, you know, you think of the flapper woman of the 20s, and it has a different, completely different aesthetic from the Victorian woman and a different set of expectations for her life.
It's interesting, too, and we'll get back to this, but after World War II, for example, you point out, you know, women were fully involved just by the circumstance of war in World War II, involved in the workforce, and they wanted to stay there. And then this movement begins to sort of get them back in the home. And they didn't want to go, and that's another sort of part of this story, which is all relevant to the bigger picture, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of that is familiar to us in a sort of sketchy way. I think that one of the things that's really interesting to me as a scholar is that when I think about the general public, the general public has a almost like a slideshow in their head. Most of us walk around, like if you say the civil rights movement, if I say that to you, you picture the Montgomery bus boycott, you picture the photograph, you picture Martin Luther King photographed in the March in Washington and that, you know, the shot of him speaking across the mall, or there's just like a Flickr account yeah. lights up in your head and you can immediately picture there's a soundscape too. You can hear King's speech. You could hear Malcolm X's voice. You have a familiarity, my kids who are in high school have that in their head. But you talk about the struggle for women's equality. I don't think many people have that much in there. Like it's actually a much vaguer sense that there is much of a history there. You may be the kind of iconic thing is some notion of this burning of bras in 1968 at the Miss America pageant, like a thing that didn't quite even really happen. Or, you know, maybe you picture Gloria Steinem in her sunglasses, aviator glasses or something. You know, there's maybe kind of some sketchy things. But that history going back to the 19th century, the history of the teens and 20s, we don't – it's not that those things weren't photographed or recorded and weren't widely known at the time, but there's a kind of a dimming of our view right. of that struggle. It has a very short shadow.
Okay, let's talk about William Moulton Marston. He's born in Massachusetts, as you say, 1893. In a family with its own castle, which is pretty interesting anyway. He's cherished and he's adored. And this is the sort of the sentence that caught my eye. Believed firmly in suicide, which is sort of an important element in his early story, that he makes this declaration that he's going to kill himself when he's a freshman at Harvard. Wasn't doing well in school. History was sort of giving him fits. Would you tell this part of the story, because it just gives you a sense of who he was and how he comes upon this idea of feminism and philosophy?
Yeah, so Marston's quite a precocious child and also much doted upon. Remember that Harvard at this time, it's not the Harvard where I teach. It's really a kind of glorified boys' school. And mostly everybody else that he meets at Harvard is a man like himself, from a wealthy New England patrician family where every expectation was that one would go to Harvard. And Marston felt himself very much destined to go to Harvard. And he gets to Harvard and things begin to fall apart for him. I think he's a emotionally vulnerable person as a late adolescent. A lot of late adolescents are emotionally vulnerable. I think he's emotionally vulnerable his whole life. He begins to fall apart. He doesn't join the football team, and he had been much expected to be a great football star.
Yeah.
And he starts doing very badly in his classes. And he had, as a young man, he had sort of great contempt for people that didn't succeed, not having any notion that much of his success was due to where he came from, not anything he himself had accomplished. But he had come up with this theory as a boy that if he ever failed, that life wouldn't really be worth living if you were going to be a failure. So he just intended to kill himself. So he began falling apart freshman year, and he got some cyanide from a friend who was studying chemistry and was planning to take it. And then he decided maybe he would just wait out the semester and take his final exams just to see what happened.
Right.
But meanwhile, this, you know, boarding school, boys Harvard, was being rocked in the fall of Marston's freshman year because Radcliffe had been founded several years before, and there had been continued pressure on the part of Radcliffe students to allow them to take classes at Harvard. The Harvard faculty, male faculty, taught the Radcliffe girls, but the girls weren't allowed to take classes with the Harvard boys.
Right.
They had to be taught at Radcliffe. And So two things happened. There was all this pressure for co-education that was obviously not realized for decades and decades, but there was a lot of pressure at that very moment. And a Harvard Men's League for Women's Suffrage had been founded just before Marston arrived. The suffrage movement, which had been kind of quiet for decades, it started in 1848 in the United States when women first demanded the right to vote. And women had, you know, largely put that fight aside to fight for abolitionism, to fight for the end of slavery, and then to fight for the enfranchisement of black men. A lot of struggle over the 15th Amendment among suffragists. But by the beginning of the 20th century, British suffragists and American suffragists kind of together said, we're tired of sort of politely asking whether we can get the right to vote. We're going to actually now be militant. We're going to get ourselves arrested. We're going to get thrown in jail. We're going to make a spectacle of ourselves. So in the UK, this militant version of suffrage was led by a woman named Emmeline Pankhurst. Mm. And she and her followers did things like chain themselves to the gates outside 10 Downing Street. They were dragged away. When they were put in prison, they went on hunger strikes. They were forcibly fed. It was very dramatic and, of course, ultimately very effective. But American suffragists were doing the same thing. So the Harvard Men's League for Women's Suffrage asked Emmeline Pankhurst to come to Harvard and speak in the fall of Marston's freshman year. And the Harvard Corporation refused to let her speak. Women weren't allowed to speak in Harvard Yard. So Pankhurst, who was not to be defeated, spoke basically in a dance hall in Harvard Square. And, you know, everybody on campus tried to go. And, like, men, there were great news reports of the Harvard boys and, you know, forming pyramids outside the walls of the building and climbing to get in and see. And Pankhurst was this firebrand. I mean, she was a pistol, and she did this rousing fire and brimstone kind of speech about why women should deserve the right to vote and why they must be granted the right to vote immediately. And it was just this revolution happening on Marston's doorstep. And between that and then his philosophy professor was the faculty sponsor for the Suffrage League and was himself an ardent feminist. Marston, I think, became a real convert to the cause of suffrage and to the cause of feminism. He threw himself into the study of philosophy, which at the time was merging with the field of – or out of philosophy was emerging the field of applied psychology, and became, by the end of, you know, his freshman year, an academic superstar and an ardent feminist.
So an ardent feminist – I just am trying to get a sense of what you make of his interest in feminism, because you say in the book part of him is kind of titillated by it. Do you think you understand – his sense of feminism, his commitment to feminism, is that clear in the picture of
no, it's not clear, nor is it clear for most of the, say, socialists who were allied with feminists. Like if you think about the Greenwich Village Bohemians, like John Reed, who was good friends with Margaret Sanger in the 1910s, a lot of what they meant by feminism, these guys, was that they believed in free love, which meant that they believed in having sex with women and not marrying them.
Yeah.
And they liked Margaret Sanger's idea of the bans on birth control ought to be lifted because that made free love more feasible. And, you know, they talked about this as if this was emancipating women. And in many ways, it is emancipating women. But, of course, like, actually just makes it easier for them to exploit women. I mean, it's not simple for any of those guys. I don't think you could look at any of those guys and say, oh, yeah, that was actually something I wholly 100% approve of and find noble.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is fairly creepy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I think that that distinguishes that alliance from many others, though.
Let's talk about Olive Byrne. Is it true that you – because I think I read somewhere where you said in some part you thought that you might want to make Olive Byrne the main character of this – I mean, she's a main character, but the actual main character to this story?
Yeah, I would have loved to have been able to do that, but she destroyed a lot of her papers, as far as I can tell. So there really wasn't enough archival stuff to place her as front and center as I wanted to, although she is really obviously a part of the triad.
She's the
story.
Explain that. Explain who she is here in this
country. So while Marston was at Harvard, and then he graduated in 1915, and he married his college sweetheart, and then they both went to law school. He went to Harvard Law School, and she went to BU, because Harvard didn't admit women, of course.
Yeah.
At that very same time in New York, where feminism was growing, Margaret Sanger and her sister, a woman named Ethel Byrne, were living together, and they were both nurses, and they both had children. Margaret Sanger had three children, one of whom died of pneumonia. And Ethel Byrne had two children, whom she had abandoned with her father's parents in order to move to New York and become a nurse. And Sanger and Byrne, Ethel Byrne, became convinced that more important than gaining the right to vote was gaining the right to have to limit the size of your family, was the fight for birth control. Birth control was illegal. Even discussing or writing about birth control was a violation of obscenity laws. So Sanger and Byrne in 1916 opened up a birth control clinic. The term birth control comes from Margaret Sanger. She coined it in a magazine she started in 1914 called The Woman Rebel that she wrote with Ethel Byrne. So they opened a birth control clinic in Brooklyn in 1916. That's the beginning of what becomes Planned Parenthood. They're arrested, And Ethel Byrne is tried first. They're both found guilty of obscenity. Ethel Byrne is sentenced to 30 days in prison. And an imitation of Emmeline Pankhurst goes on a hunger strike.
Right.
It's on the front page of every newspaper. She nearly dies. And the only reason she doesn't die is that Margaret Sanger makes a deal with the governor of New York that if he pardons Ethel Byrne, Sanger will promise that Ethel Byrne will no longer be involved in the birth control movement. That she's just and so that's why you've heard of Margaret Sanger but never heard of Ethel Byrne.
Right.
The movement really was both of their movements. But Ethel Byrne immediately then disappears from the movement. Never ever forgives her sister for doing this because she was by far the more radical of the two of them, and in some ways the more committed to a kind of notion of women's biological freedom than Sanger was. Sanger had many other kinds of causes that she was attempting to advance. In any case, one of the things that a deal that they make later on, Ethel Byrne's, her daughter, Olive Byrne, has been raised in convent schools, and Ethel Byrne wants her daughter to become a doctor. Like, this is her life's passion, that her daughter would become a doctor. And Ethel Byrne has no money, but Margaret Sanger marries this oil magnate in 1921 or 1922, and he agrees to pay for Olive Byrne to go to college. So she goes to Tufts in the 1920s, where when she's a senior, she meets William Moulton Marston, who's her psychology professor.
Yeah.
And they fall in love. Now, he's been married for 10 years. He and his wife don't have any children yet. They haven't been able to figure out how to have children and both have their careers. And Marston falls in love with Olive Byrne, who's 10 years younger than he is, and he tells his wife that he wants her to move in with them, and he thinks they should live as a threesome, and either she can move in or he'll leave his wife, is kind of the ultimatum that he supposedly gives to her. At least this is what Margaret Sanger's granddaughter told me. So they form a family, and this is in 1925. This is extremely kooky solution to what was known in the 1920s as the woman's dilemma. That is the dilemma of the new woman that you were alluding to before. If you've got an education and you have training to do some really interesting professional work, what would you do if you want to also have children? Well, there really is no daycare, and you whatever. There's all these articles in the magazines. You can't trust a nanny, blah, blah. Well, Margaret Marston, I have this very well-educated young woman who'd be happy to raise your children if we bring her into our house. And so each woman has two children, and they form a family and stay together for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Even after Marston dies. Prematurely.
Yeah, even after Marston dies, the women stay together for decades and decades and decades.
Yeah. It's such a intricate and fascinating story. And one of the things that you mentioned, I love this element where Ethel and Margaret are in Greenwich Village, you know, living this free love lifestyle. There's socialism, there's feminism. It's an amazingly free life going on. And you say in the book that Wonder Woman, in essence, was born in Bohemia, that Amazons were everywhere in Greenwich Village. And the story of Wonder Woman, you know, being this princess on this island, this is a stock feminist plot. I mean, these are kind of the beginnings of the story before we actually get to the creation of Wonder Woman, I guess.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me that people could have read Wonder Woman comics for so long and, you know, doted upon the minutiae in them and the different character developments and this artist versus that artist, and not seen the way in which the character herself is the creation of 19 teens era feminism.
Yeah.
And the reason for that, though, is, I think, pretty clear when you think about it. The people who write about the history of comics and the people who write about the history of feminism are not the same.
It's right. Not
the same people.
Yeah.
And they don't talk to one another. I mean, because the obverse is true as well, right? Historians of feminism have paid no attention to Wonder Woman or not seen Wonder Woman as a product of that earlier era in the history of the struggle for women's rights because they don't look at comic books. Mm. So this is this kind of big elephant in the feminist room.
Jill Lepore is with us. Her book is The Secret History of Wonder Woman. It's now out in paperback. And I'm late for a break, so we need to get to a break. We'll get to the story of Wonder Woman when we get back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio Westenberg for Brizio. The historian Jill Lepore is with us. We're talking about her fascinating book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. She's joining us from the campus of Harvard, where she's a professor of American history there. She's also, as you probably know, staff writer at The New Yorker. The Secret History of Wonder Woman is her latest book. As I mentioned, it's out in paperback. Let me read the first sentence of chapter 21. On November 10th, 1937, William Marston held a press conference and issued a prediction: women would one day rule the world. Pick us up on that story, because this is AP picks up this story. I mean, he's basically – he has this wild idea that matriarchy is inevitable, and eventually we'll get there.
So Marston is basically a huckster in the 1930s. He finishes his law degree at Harvard, gets a PhD in psychology, invents a lie detector, sort of markets it, is not altogether successful. He's arrested for fraud. There are various complications. Then he forms this family with two women. He has an academic career. He teaches at Columbia. He's basically drummed out of the academy when his colleagues understand his domestic arrangements.
Yeah.
He, in 1928, writes this kooky book called The Emotions of Normal People, which is kind of an indictment of abnormal psychology, in which he says, you know what, anybody you want to have sex with, whatever you want to do with is fine. Like, it's a very forward-looking account of, like, people actually find it very interesting now, but at the time it was deeply
crazy,
controversial, yeah, I guess, and mostly ignored. And it will give you a good sense of Marston's ethics and the family ethics when I say the only review I was ever able to find of Emotions of Normal People was written by Olive Byrne. So not a thing that really passed muster as meeting the ethics of book reviewing. So in the 1930s, it's the Depression. The family's really struggling. They have four children. Elizabeth Holloway Marston's working as a lawyer and supporting the whole family. Olive Byrne's home taking care of the kids. And Marston is just kind of putting together anything that he can find. He bills himself as the world's first consulting psychologist, which is a bit of a tip of the hat to Sherlock Holmes, the world's first consulting detective. He goes out to Hollywood as a consulting psychologist, and he hooks people up to his lie detector to sort of predict out whether movies are going to be successful or not. This is before George Gallup does the same thing in the 1930s. And he's almost like a kind of combination between a televangelist and a psychic, like, except he has like three Harvard degrees, so he looks really legitimate. But he's forever doing things like holding press conferences to launch his new books. And by the late 1930s, he's become really smitten with his theories about sexual difference, something he's written about a lot as a psychologist and during his earlier sort of more legitimate years as a psychologist. But something that's actually also the family story. Like, at this point, he's been living with Olive Byrne for a long time. He knows Ethel Byrne very well. She's the grandmother to his children. They summer with Ethel Byrne on Cape Cod every summer. Margaret Sanger is visiting the family on and off all the time. Like, this is his world, world of these incredibly
powerful women,
active feminists.
Yeah.
And 1937 is a big year for Sanger. She wins this really important case, U.S. v. a box of Japanese pessaries. Pessaries are diaphragms. So the birth control movement is forging ahead. And Marston makes this big prediction mainly just to get in the news so that he can sell his latest book, which is about why you shouldn't kill yourself. So, I mean, he's just – I can't even think of a figure. He's a kind of Dr. Oz sort of figure, maybe. And, like, he has both a kind of legitimacy and then an extreme kookiness.
Yeah.
So, he starts peddling himself as quite professedly a feminist. Now, this is at the same time he's writing for men's magazines. He writes for Esquire, which is like Playboy before there's Playboy. Marston is on staff of Esquire in the 1930s. And meanwhile, Olive Byrne, to help bring in money to this family that's struggling during the Depression, has become a staff writer for Family Circle, which is a new magazine that's free. You get it at the grocery store for free. It's a giveaway. It's like full of coupons. It's a little different than it is now, but it's the same kind of, like, it's for housewives.
Sure.
About how to live, like, how to raise your children to be upright. And this is my favorite thing about the whole story. I just love that they clearly are delighting in the fiction that is their family life. Like, Olive Byrne's, most of her articles for Family Circle are, she goes to visit world-famous consulting psychologist William Moulton Marston and asks him for advice about how to raise her children.
Yeah. Even though she's living with him and having her
even she's living with him, yeah. She's living with him for years. They are his children.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's this willingness to sort of anything goes. There's anything goes ethically, that's for sure. But there's a kind of desperation, and there's a part of the hedonism and the free love kind of convention of the family.
And then there's this other thing going on. This is in the late 30s, and Americans are kind of freaking out about fascism. And so Superman is seen as, too violent, as kind of a fascist, because of course fascism is raging in Europe right now, and Americans are uneasy with the idea that Batman has a gun. This is the other thing
Superman,
that's going on.
Yeah, Superman debuts in 1938 and Batman in 1939. When Batman starts, he has a gun and he shoots and kills villains.
Yeah.
This is controversial. 1938 and 9 are the years of some of the biggest gun control advances in the history of the country. There's a law. There's a Federal Firearms Act and a National Firearms Act in 34, 38 and 39. The U.S. Supreme Court upholds both of those. Americans just, you know, are not kind of gung-ho about guns in the 1930s. There's a lot of organized crime. So, you know, machine guns become virtually prohibited through that federal gun legislation. So the publisher of Batman retracts that whole storyline, invents a backstory for an origin story for Batman, for Bruce Wayne, which he'd seen his parents shot as a little kid.
Yeah.
And that's why he hates guns, and Batman is kind of disarmed. Meanwhile, Olive Byrne writes an article for Family Circle about – she goes to see William Moulton Marston and asks him, like, are comic books good or bad for my children? Because there's so much controversy over the comic books. Are they going to make my boys violent, or are they okay? Are they harmless? And Marston says, no, they're harmless. They're great. They're like fairy tales. It's like Little Red Riding Hood or Hansel and Gretel. And so this guy, M.C. Gaines, who's the most important comic book publisher, superhero publisher, brings Marston in and hires him as a consultant and says, what are we going to do about our – he's basically our PR problem. Like,
yeah.
Where people are burning comic books in the streets. Parents are so alarmed. And Marston says, oh, I have an idea. What you really need is a female superhero.
And it takes off. So let's talk about the origin story. I mean, she comes from this, you know, this island of Amazonian women who live forever without men, and they live in peace and harmony. And give us a sense of where this is not a new story, where it comes from, though.
Yeah. So Wonder Woman makes her debut at the end of 1941, just before the U.S. is entering the war.
Right.
And she's, interestingly, a pacifist, but she's most explicitly a feminist. So she comes from Paradise Island. She's the daughter of the Queen of Paradise Island. It's a land with no men. And it's this ancient Greek story about Amazons. And it turns out that this story has been a staple of feminist fiction for decades and was really common in the 19-teens when Charlotte Perkins Gilman wrote Her Land, for instance. It's a very similar story. There are all these like novels and short stories that are published in the 19-teens that involve the very same, you know, there's this special island where there are only women and they have all the power and it's contaminated when men arrive and they have to figure out what to do with the men. Which is exactly how Wonder Woman starts. So this U.S. Air Force pilot crashes. It's not the Air Force yet, whatever, Army Air Corps.
Right.
Pilot crashes on Paradise Island, and Diana, who's the princess of the Amazons, is chosen to bring him back to the United States. And, you know, the entire storyline is stolen from Charlotte Perkins Gilman. But Marston's idea was you could resurrect all this feminist stuff from the 19-teens, which, again, was also very pacifist, right? A big part of suffragism and feminism in the 19-teens was opposition to U.S. entry into the war. You know, the cause was split, but there's a lot of pacifism closely allied with feminism. And so he has this sort of pacifist feminist who's fighting for equal rights. She decides to go to the United States, and she's dressed in like an American flag and has an American eagle across her breasts.
Yeah.
That she's going to fight for peace, justice, and women's rights. That's why she's going to be the last bastion of equal rights for women, is what the United States represents to her. So there's this melding of the fight against fascists,
yeah,
with the fight for feminism, so that you could use fascism to fight feminism, and that you wouldn't need to use guns, and you wouldn't need to beat people up and be stronger than they are. You could actually just be more beautiful, and you could believe in truth and love, and you would fight with love. And, you know, Wonder Woman's greatest power is love. Love,
right.
Love stronger than force is Marston's big message as a psychologist, as a practicing clinical psychologist. That's his big idea. And then she has this golden lasso, and anyone she ropes has to tell the truth. That's just Marston's lie detector.
Right.
Repurposed. And then she has these shackles, which are the thing about Wonder Woman that people remember and turns out to really backfire for M.C. Gaines, because he's hired Marston to create this character that'll be uncontroversial and quiet all the critics. But turns out Wonder Woman is far more controversial than Batman or Superman.
It's interesting. So mainstream Americans who are encountering this comic, because it was popular, right? I mean, it was really popular for its time.
Yeah, I mean, it was the only thing that was more popular were Superman and Batman.
Yeah.
And also historically, you know, there are all these – this is a so-called golden age of comics in the 1940s and the late 1930s. Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman are the only three that have been continuously in print all this time since they're starting. It's not only that she's super popular then, she's elected to join the Justice Society by a reader's poll.
Yeah.
And she gets her own comic book in 1942. She's in every other comic book. She's always on the cover of every other comic book. But that she has a lastingness. I mean, she's transformed over time, but she has a lastingness that only Superman and Batman also have.
But what do you make of that, that it would be popular, that a woman who is unabashedly for, you know, women's rights, how do you understand that? I mean, I get how that would be big for activists and intellectuals, but why would mainstream Americans take to that comic, do you think?
Well, it coincides with that Rosie the Riveter moment of the Second World War, where as a in the case of a national emergency, women are asked to take on roles that they have previously not been encouraged to take on. There's been a real retrenchment since that moment of the new woman in the 1920s. But by the 1940s, women are again being told, you know what, it would be really good if you would go get a job, even if you're married, even if you have children. Factories begin providing daycare. There's this, you know, there are the WACs. There's incredible political and economic and cultural momentum for women to go out into the paid workforce in a way and at a scale that has never before taken place. And in many ways, that is the Wonder Woman storyline as well. It's not necessary. You could read it as not necessarily like this is we should transform relations between the sexes permanently. You could read it as we are facing a national emergency. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you know, it's good that Wonder Woman is around because we need even women right now.
Yeah. So if you're to be truly honest about the backstory of Wonder Woman, I mean, the image of her, you know, constantly being tied up and bound and gagged does reflect Marston's kind of proclivities, I think. I mean, it seems like – and you do write about that, and we can get back to that. But it seems like you're even more interested in the part that chains and ropes played in the early feminist movement, because this idea of being in bondage wasn't kinky. I mean, it was a big theme.
Yeah, so I'm interested in emphasizing it just because I think the kinkiness is so obvious and undeniable.
Yeah.
Like, yes, I will stipulate it is kinky.
Right.
And it is specifically about a certain kind of eroticism. And it's a certain kind of eroticism that involves domination. And many people would find extremely distasteful. Like, I totally stipulate that.
Yeah.
And that does come from Marston and that it is meant to work that way at many levels. But what most people don't see and can't see because it's invisible unless you're a historian is that Marston's defense of it is also true. So people begin complaining because Wonder Woman has these bracelets and she's often chained up. So the bracelets themselves are a little kinky kind of bondage. She also wears these high-heeled boots. But she's in almost every episode, she's either roped or she's chained or she's gagged or she can be hog-tied. Most often she's chained. And, of course, she always breaks free. And she always breaks herself free. Like, she's never rescued. This is a really big – this distinguishes Wonder Woman significantly. And then, you know, mainly she's rescuing other people. But people began complaining. And one member of the editorial advisory board of the comic book publisher, you know, resigned in protest. And Marston kept saying, you know what, this is actually this is psychologically symbolic. The whole character I have created as an allegory for the emancipation of women, for the emancipated woman. And in order to communicate that, she needs to be bound so that she can emancipate herself. The allegory has to be expressed through her emancipating herself. And you think like, oh, seriously, that's really why you keep her wandering around in chains all the time? Like, she's got the gag in and, you know, she's got this. My favorite is she's like got shackles on her feet, but she's on roller skates so she can still move around. I mean, they're the most contorted, confected, weird things. But it is absolutely the case if you look at the iconography of the suffrage and feminist and birth control movements from the 19-teens and 20s, women are tied up and chained up all the time. In reality, in the kind of political theater that they undertake, like Emmeline Pankhurst chaining herself to the gates outside 10 Downing Street or American suffragists chaining themselves to the gates outside the White House, women march in suffrage parades all over the United States in chains and shackles, or they'll be dragging like these fake balls and chains and stuff. And if you look at their magazines, the suffrage newspapers, suffrage magazines, women are always chained up. And it's a carry-on from the iconography of the abolitionist movement. Mm-hmm. Women said, we are, you know, when they were fighting for freedom for enslaved men and women, we are like them, that the tyranny that men have over us, the authority that men wield over women is like that of a master over a slave. And we are politically enslaved. I mean, the American revolutionaries said they were slaves. They used these same images. They put themselves in chains all the time to sort of iconographically to talk about that they were as slaves politically because they were so disenfranchised. So there's a longstanding tradition of doing this. And Marston recycles it. And most people have kind of forgotten it. So it you know, certainly little kids don't – they're not immediately picturing suffragists marching in Washington in 1916 when they see Wonder Woman in her, like, pinup outfit with chains. But Marston isn't making that up. That is a very well-chronicled and just pervasive iconography.
Jill Lepore is with us. Her book is The Secret History of Wonder Woman. It's just out in paperback. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the historian Jill Lepore. We're talking about her book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. It just came out in paperback. I have to say that what happens to Wonder Woman is kind of sad. I mean, a man named Robert Kaniger takes over the strip eventually after Marston dies, and he hates Wonder Woman. I can't believe he takes it over, and it really starts to change at this point. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, so Marston dies in 1947, and at the very same time, the longtime editor of Wonder Woman, this guy named Shelley Mayer, quits, stops working for what is basically DC Comics, becomes DC Comics. And a young woman, very young woman named Joy Hummel, who'd written a lot of the stories because Marston had polio starting in 1944. Joy Hummel had written a lot of the stories. She gets married, and she also quits. So there's nobody really kind of continuing on. And Marston's widow, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, writes to the head of DC Comics and says, you know, I could take it over. And I think what she means by that, I and Olive Byrne could take it over. It had been a family project from the start in many ways. It really wasn't just Marston who was writing the stories and thinking them up. The kids even thought of plot lines all the time. And she's, you know, unceremoniously brushed aside as a meddling female. And so they bring on this guy, Robert Kaniger, to take over the story. It's important to remember at the time, all of the superhero comics were kind of falling apart because their great heyday was the war itself, mm-hmm. when they were basically fighting Nazis. And so for all of those superhero comics from the Golden Age, you know, most of them just stopped publishing after the war. They just go out of print, or the Justice League disbands, kind of things like just the whole apparatus begins to fall apart. So it's not just Wonder Woman. But Kaniger hates Wonder Woman. And also the moment when, at the level of popular culture, it was possible to have such a strong female hero has passed. Women are told at the end of the war, you know, thanks for all your help, but we don't need you at the factories anymore. If you don't quit, we'll fire you. You need to make room for returning servicemen. And so even women who want to stay working and who very much need to work, or women who'd worked even before the war, you know, the idea that, like, women only began working for pay in the Second World War, that just completely ignores the fact that black women have been working for pay all along. But those women, too, are also forced out of the labor force and really into poverty in order to make room for returning servicemen, for white returning servicemen above all. And, you know, you should have more children, and the baby boom starts. And so they don't really know what to do with Wonder Woman. They like the DC Comics likes the idea of continuing the character because she has a ton of readers. There's a lot of reader loyalty to the character. But they kind of defang her. You know, she loses even like her kinky boots. She wears like these ballerina slippers. And she's kind of daffy, and she kind of wanders around being kind of dopey about Steve Trevor, who's the captain, the Air Force captain she's supposedly in love with. And I don't know, she becomes like a model. And then she writes advice to the Lovelorn for a newspaper column. I mean, she just has these incredibly pathetic storylines. But she's just a kind of bellwether for what's going on with women across the culture. You can kind of trace it through. It just works that way from start to finish.
Well, what about the Linda Carter Wonder Woman from the 70s? Because this is going on. I mean, what's ironic about it is Linda Carter was a former beauty queen. And this comes at a time when feminism is really fighting against that whole concept.
Yeah. So the Linda Carter show, which starts, I think, in 1975, is produced by ABC in order to take advantage of how popular Wonder Woman has become with second wave feminists, with women of the women's liberation movement. So Wonder Woman begins enjoying a renaissance not because DC Comics reinvents the character, because although DC Comics does reinvent the character, they don't make it appealing to women readers. Yeah. But women like Gloria Steinem, who'd grown up reading Wonder Woman in the 40s, begin playing with the icon. So New York Magazine, which Steinem's a staff writer for in 1967, has this great cartoon called The Liberated Lady. It's drawn by Edward Sorel, and it's Wonder Woman, and she's fighting rapists. And then when Steinem founds Ms. Magazine in 1972, she puts Wonder Woman on the cover. She's running for president.
Right.
Wonder Woman is all over the place in the print culture of the feminist movement in the 1960s and 70s. There's this great brochure for the National Women's Political Caucus from 1974, which is supposed to be the year of the woman. It's a photograph of Nixon with his cabinet at a long table in a meeting, and someone has been erased and Wonder Woman is seated in his seat, and she's like ruling the meeting. There's this great – one of my favorites of these is a newsletter for kind of like an underground women's health collective from L.A. from 1973, and Wonder Woman's on the cover, and she's wielding a speculum, and inside she gives instructions on how to conduct a vaginal self-exam. the character is really popular among these women because they've kind of grown up with the more politicized Wonder Woman from when they were kids. What they don't know, Steinem doesn't know, nobody knows, is that Wonder Woman wielding a speculum – is very true to the character's origins.
Right, you know,
that
Wonder totally.
Woman is really based on these women who fought for birth control in the 19-teens and fought for the right to vote, and that's lost on those women. So they think they have just kind of reinvented. They've taken this character from superhero from their childhood and made her political in a new way, but that's not what's happened at all. And that's one of the things that, you know, I was really excited to write the book about, to illustrate that there is this incredible continuity across the 20th century of this very long struggle for the fight for equality for women.
You write about, let me ask you this finally because we're pretty much out of time, but you write about how the comic book industry doesn't really know what to do with the women's movement, at least in the 70s. So they start a couple of things like Night Nurse and Shanna the She-Devil and The Cat, but all of those don't last very long. And I'm wondering, I don't get a sense you read many comic books these days, but what are you seeing in the way of images of comics today?
Well, there's a lot going on right now. Marvel has this whole new A-Force that's a kind of whole group of women. It's like a Justice League of just women. There's a new Wonder Woman movie coming out. I mean, generally, they draw on the same iconography of pornography that Marston's Wonder Woman drew on. That is also a continuity of the representation of women in comic books, whether it's Wonder Woman or anyone else. I think what's most concerning is that they're fully weaponized. Wonder Woman, who starts out as a pacifist in the 1940s, when they reboot the character in 2012, she's like got a handgun and like a golden handgun in each hand, and she's like firing. And the images you've seen from the new movie, she's also exceedingly well armed.
Yeah. It's Jill Lepore. She teaches history at Harvard University, a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her book is called The Secret History of Wonder Woman. It's now out in paperback. She joined us from Harvard. Jill Lepore, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks again.
Radio West, production of KUER News, with thanks to our new intern, Lindsay Vickers. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.